Sure, you are in fellowship.
And continue on here,
dealing with this issue of going through the motions without the internal realities that God is looking for, and ritual without reality, which Solomon warns his younger audience God is not impressed with. And as we're going to see, he will continue to emphasize this in chapter 5, at least through the first 7 verses, dealing with issues related to keeping your word and these types of things. So the point we stopped at here was number 48. Some people appear to make many sacrifices for God and his plan. However, one must be willing to examine the internal motivations that prompt such sacrifices. Since wrong motivations make the sacrifice unacceptable to God, people do things out of approbation lust, Matthew 6, 2, 5, and 16, because they want people to think highly of them. And so they do certain things. So people will think highly of them. So when you give to the poor, do not sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, so that they may be honored by men. And this is why giving, of course, as we've always tried to keep it as private as possible. Simply put, we have an obligation to give, but each believer, what they do, that's between them and God. It stays that way. The only person that knows anything is the person of the treasurer that has to give a report. But dollar amounts and all of that, I've never known, never have known, never do know, never will care, frankly, who gives what. It's really irrelevant. And some people do that because they want people to think they're great spiritually. When you pray, don't be like the hypocrites, for they love to stand and pray in the synagogues on the street so they may be seen by men. And verse 16, when you fast, don't put on a gloomy face as the hypocrites do. I'm sacrificing for God and his plan. I want everybody to know it. And so they will be noticed by men. Truly, I say to you, they have their reward in full. What is their reward? For men to notice them. They get their approbation lust stroke. Some people do things out of malice, Matthew 22. They're not necessarily doing it for the right reasons, right motivation, of course. They're doing it to twit somebody else. But when Jesus perceived their malice, he said, why are you testing me, you hypocrites? Show me the coin used for the poll tax. And he brought him a denarius, and he said, do you think they were really concerned about the tax? Do you really think that was their motivation in all of this? No, they were trying to trip Jesus up. They weren't concerned with whether or not he paid taxes. That was just a smokescreen to cover their real motive, which was malice. That wasn't ever an issue. And you think they were concerned that Caesar wasn't getting his from Jesus? That wasn't what they were all about. What they were all about was trying to make Jesus look bad. 15 through 18, the Pharisees went up and plotted how they might trap him in what he said. You know, that's what people do. They plot, scheme, to try to trap people. See if they can get them to trip up. Well, that's great motivation, isn't it? Not hardly. And they sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians saying, teacher, we know that you're a truth. Oh yeah, here they come with the smoke screen. We're just here because we're concerned about God and his plan. No, you're not. You're here out of malice. And Jesus knew it. He wasn't fooled by it. Don't be fooled by people and their plausible little rationales and their phony smoke screens of what they're really all about. This is where having discernment is absolutely critical. Being able to see through people. Not just taking them at what they say on the surface. But looking deeper. We know that you're truthful. You're just a wonderful teacher. We're here because we love you. No, you're not. Don't give me that. I'm not stupid. Jesus wasn't stupid. You teach the way of God in truth and defer to no one, for you're not partial to any. Tell us then, what do you think? Is it lawful to give a poll tax to Caesar or not? But when Jesus perceived their malice, he said, why are you testing me, you hypocrites? You don't care about taxes. What are you worried about, Uncle Sam? You worried about the IRS? Is that really your concern? No, you're trying to trip me up. I know what you're here for. I know what you're all about. It's not lost on me. And so they couldn't trip him up, though, because he hadn't done anything wrong. They weren't going to catch him because he hadn't done anything. See, monetary lust. Some people do stuff. I've heard this out of believers' mouth. I just want to give so God will give me more. Well, then, wait a minute. What's your motive here? Now, I'm not saying God doesn't bless people that give, but if that's your motive, I'm not sure God honors that. You should give because it's the right thing to do. You should give because you're led by the Spirit to do so. But if your inner motive is, I'm going to give, so, you know, that's just the fundy prosperity gospels, all that is. And I've heard that out of people that supposedly quote sound in doctrine. They're not. That's not sound in doctrine. And Matthew 7:6. He said to them, rightly did Isaiah, or pardon me, Mark here, 7:6. What was all this about? Well, this was their Corban gimmick. Neglecting the commandment of God. You hold to the traditions of men. They were worried about your disciples in verse 5. Your disciples do not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but they eat bread with impure hands, unclean hands. He said, you're hypocrites. Are you really that concerned about how my disciples eat? Is that really what this is about? No, it never was about the disciples and how they ate. He said to them, you are experts at setting aside the commandment of God, verse 9, in order to keep your tradition. Experts! Not just do it occasionally. Not just pretty good at it, you're experts at it. In order to get what you want, you set aside the commandment of God. And you feel justified in it. Of course they did. They felt justified in this. And Moses said, honor your father and your mother. And in this context, of course, honoring father and mother, and in all contexts, really honoring father and mother is not, you know, that you owe them any big allegiance. It's about money. This is what the bottom line of this is. It's money. Once you're old enough and you're out of the house, you're no longer under your parents' authority, well then, fine. The only obligation you have to them at that point is if their financial situation becomes such that they need financial help, you're obligated as a believer to help them. Honor your father and mother. So don't give me this, I'm going to go associate with my negative relatives because I'm honoring father and mother. That's not what these verses are teaching. To violate the doctrine of separation under the guise of honoring father and mother is not what these verses are teaching. He who speaks evil of father or mother is to be put to death. But you say if a man says to his father or mother, whatever I have that I could help you is Corban, that is to say, given to God. But you no longer permit him to do anything for his father or his mother, thus invalidating the word of God by your tradition, which you have handed down. And we saw this under the principle of the widows. Those that don't take care of their own household are worse than unbelievers. They have denied the faith. And so you have an obligation to help your parents. You don't have an obligation to socialize with them because they're negative. Don't use these verses to try to justify that. But you do have a financial obligation to them. And even if they're negative, you still have a financial obligation. Jesus didn't say, well, if your parents are positive, you help them. But if they're negative, you can write them off. No, you still have an obligation. Should it become necessary? Most of us, of course, we're the baby boomers. Our parents all had, you know, jobs and retired and, you know, all that. And most of them are pretty well taken care of. They were savers. They tended to put their money aside, buy insurance and all this. And, you know, many of them were, you know, some of them are insurance poor. Monetary lust here. You're doing all this and the whole point is you're invalidating the word of God in order to keep your money in the bank. Well, that's inappropriate. D, power and position, 1 Timothy 1:7. Again, a verse we saw not that long ago. What do you think it was that motivated Hymenaeus and Alexander? They wanted to be big shots in the church. Why, that was their church. It's not their church. It's God's church. And Timothy is the overseer. Paul was the major overseer but as the apostle there. But Timothy now is appointed as the overseer. And Paul's tossed them out on their ears. Why? Because they were pursuing power. They were under power lust. And false doctrine at some level, too. Maybe the two go hand in hand. I don't know. Certainly seems to in their case. Here we saw, I mean, it wasn't just Hymenaeus and Alexander. There were others involved in it. Those were the most notable examples, though. You know. You toss out the ringleaders on their ears, and it certainly shuts down some of the rest of them. Wanting to be teachers of the law. Why? Why? Because they wanted the, quote, prestige that came with it. Some people, that's why they want to be in the ministry. They want people to look up to them. Well, let me give you a news break. People don't look up to you just because you're in the ministry. That is a that doesn't work all the time. And in fact, you're just more of a target. That's all you become. So you just have to deal with that. If you're getting in the ministry out of approbation, you just better find yourself another line of work. It doesn't work. So they wanted the prestige of that the rabbis enjoyed. Oh, we know you're a great teacher. Wanting to be teachers of the law, even though they do not understand what they are saying, or the matters about which they make dogmatic assertions. And their misplaced dogmatism, and they're way off base, completely off base. And why? Because they wanted people to like them, to look up to them, to say, oh, rabbi, or father, or whatever title they want to be called. That's why I've always, I mean always, from day one, I never liked it even as a fundy. I didn't fall into it. You know, Reverend Snyder, just call me Ron. Ron's fine. You know, I'm not interested in your titles. I'm not in it for that. I'm not in it for you to look up to me and say, oh, good, he's a great teacher of the law. At first, that was all misguided in itself, wanting to be teachers of the law. The law wasn't to be taught at that level. We're under the principle of grace. And so he does. And because some people reject this, verse 19, keeping faith and a good conscience, which some have rejected and suffered shipwreck in regard to their doctrine. Among those are Hymenaeus and Alexander. So they were the ringleaders of the... And again, in any conspiracy, you have the ringleaders, and then you have the dupes, and you have the henchmen. And the henchmen execute the will of the ringleaders. The ringleaders tend to stay in the background so that they're not as visible. And then the dupes, these are the major people, the majority of the people in the conspiracy, but they don't really know what's going on. They don't even understand the issues. But they get involved in it. They get caught up in it. So people do things for all kinds of reasons. Guess what? Doesn't make it acceptable to God. So prestige isn't it. Monetary lust isn't it. Malice isn't any good reason to do stuff. No, but people just do that because they're hateful. Well, 49, the last portion of verse 1 is difficult. Since the normal understanding of the verb for knowing, when prefixed with coupled with a prefix lamed and an infinitive construct, indicates knowing how to do something. And the alternative translation here would be to take the subject of this as your feet, rather than the fools from the preceding context. But Exodus, let me show you the typically this is the way this construction works. Exodus 36:1. Now Bezalel and Oholiab and every skillful person in whom the Lord has put skill and understanding to know how to perform all the work. That's a prefix lamed with an infinitive construct of yada. To know how to do something. And alternately, of course, you can just translate this as to perform. But the idea here is, again, it has the sense of knowing how to do it. 1 Kings 5:20 also, you have that same construction used. This is where, and you know, I was talking to Pete the other day, this is Bible Works can be, you know, a great tool. I mean, it's very quick to search out these constructions that, I mean, God, you would have been forever doing this manually. but it does have its limitations. For instance, he pointed out that in the text, in the Hebrew text, even the Masoretes, although you have some verses or some versions that translate chapter 5, verse 1 as a part of 4:19, as a part of chapter 4, but if you look at the Masoretic text, it's clear that it's not, that they even made the distinction there. They changed the form. 1 Kings 5:20. But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, thought, behold, my master has spared Naaman the Aramean. By not receiving from his hands what he has brought, that doesn't sound like the right verse. That's because I'm in 2 Kings. No, scratch that. Okay. Let's try 1 Kings 5:20. See if that's the right one. I guess it is kind of important to be in the right book. I don't think that's the right one either. Well, I tell you what, I must have been on a roll that day. Well, I know it's not 2 Kings because that's not it either. So scratch that verse and let's try 2 Chronicles 2:6. Trust me, there probably is a verse in Kings that uses that construction. You'll have to trust me because I can't find it. At least not right now. That's why I'm almost tempted to have Bible works up here. I could fix this mistake right now. But that's not necessarily. 2 Chronicles 2:6. But who is able to build a house for him? For the heavens and the highest heavens cannot contain him. So who am I that I should build a house for him? Except to burn incense before him. Now send me a skilled man to work. And that actually should be verse 7 there. 2:7 is the verse we're looking for. That know how to make engravings. To work with skilled men. And I know what happened. Oh, you know what? Okay, well, we'll scratch the King's one. But sometimes in these texts, the Hebrew text, the Masoretic text, is one verse off from our English translation. And that's what happened there. I probably looked it up in the Hebrew text and put down 2:6, and it's actually 2:7 in the English. Ecclesiastes 4:13. So the Chronicles one should be changed to 7. And this was a verse we had just seen not very long ago. A poor yet wise lad is better than an old and foolish king who no longer knows how to receive instruction. 6:8, also in the same book. For what advantage does the wise man have over the fool? What advantage does the poor man have knowing how to walk before the living? And you can also see 10:15. So 50, if this phrase is to be understood in the normal sense, Solomon is saying that fools do not know how to do wrong or evil. But 51, this hardly seems likely in the context. The implication of the sentence is that they do not draw near to listen and that their foolish sacrifice is unacceptable to God. So 52, it seems preferable to understand the phrase as it is rendered in most translations, which indicates that fools are not even conscious that they're doing wrong or evil before God. And again, an alternate translation here would be to make the antecedent, they do not know how to do evil, would be the feet. And hence the necessity for guarding your feet, because they can lead you into evil. Even though they themselves are, inanimate, they can't think. It's not your feet that do it, per se. But you've got to be cognizant of what your feet can get you into. And then in that case, you would translate it, not like the New American Standard is translated, but you would say, for your feet do not know how to do evil. Which, obviously, your feet can get you into trouble, though. That's the whole point of all of this. So I don't think it materially changes, again, the thrust of the verse, no matter how you translate it here. But that would be a little smoother and the more natural rendition of knowing how to do it. But again, the whole point of all of this is that fools are doing this, and God doesn't want, and Solomon doesn't want his audience to do it. So 53, this is the problem with the fool, who has lowered himself to a level of stupidity that does not allow him to properly assess his own position. Again, the way of a fool is right in his own eyes. And yet he's going through this motion, rendering these unacceptable sacrifices, and thinks he's okay before God. And yet, no, he's not. Not at all. 54, those that opt for foolishness quickly become deluded as to their actual position before God. They are, in fact, wronging God by going through their religious motions, which are not grounded in the principles of sound doctrine. 55, people that have left face-to-face teaching and continue to go through the motions of, quote, getting doctrine via electronic means, by tapes, CDs, DVDs, etc., are simply fooling themselves as to their true spiritual condition. And I've got a lot of people on my Lupe list that began very early, strangely enough, even back when I was at Maranatha. The woman actually responsible for getting me on doctrine went down this path, blew off face-to-face teaching, and lived on tapes, even though she was within driving distance of the church and came for some time. In fact, even played piano there for some time, for before class and when they did their singing. And so that was where my Lupe list started, was with her, going down this very road. left face-to-face teaching, even when it was available, and went off and lived on tapes and felt like she was okay. I exhorted her, but it didn't make any difference. And at a certain point, if people are that stupid, and they really think that they're really going to get the job done that way, well, then that's pretty dumb. You cannot fulfill so many imperatives apart from a local church. And you have to have that organized body. It just has to. And again, you have to deal with the issue of authority, which you don't have to with it. You know, on the internet, you can just turn it off. I don't like what he's saying. Go to the next class. And then again, of course, you can't be pastored, because how could a pastor pastor you when he doesn't even know you? You know, this idea of I'm the pastor to everybody. No, you're not. You can only pastor the people in front of you. You can only deal with the sheep that have been allotted to you. And you're not the pastor of everybody. And that's another reason why people like this, though. They don't have to deal then with authority. And again, back about the fifth year we were here. That was the group, the big group that left at that time. That was their deal. We don't need a pastor. Let's just get a tape group going and listen to tapes. And again, think about the nicety of that. You don't have to make any spiritual sacrifices. You don't have to make any financial sacrifices. You never have to support anything. And because all the doctrinal ministries that I know of provide all the doctrine for free. So you're really off the hook in regard to a whole lot of things. But unfortunately, my contention is you can't get to maturity that way, and you will not get your crown that way. I do not believe that. I believe God established the local church. This is the household of God. And I am the overseer of it. So 56, similarly, those that have been exposed to the truth of doctrine and return to the fundamentalist camp. I got many on my Lupe list that are in that category. They go back to being fundies, or like dogs that return to their vomit. Proverbs 26:11. And again, if you never were out there, I guess in some ways it's fortunate. If you weren't drugged through all that fundy crap, as I like to call it, or worse, you're fortunate. But for those of us who were and who can remember, it's pretty odious. We're not interested in going back. Whether you were a Baptist or a Nazarene or a Church of God or Church of Christ or this or that or whatever it was out there. And I've seen people do this. They turn around from sound doctrine, start rejecting what the pulpit's telling them, and go off and go back and become fundies, essentially. And they're back in the Baptist church or this church or that church, but it's not sound doctrine. And that's just, to me, that is, God, kill me before that happens. Like a dog that returns to his vomit, so is a fool that repeats his folly. To go back to being a Baptist after you came out of that junk, I mean, yeah. Again, those of us that have been drugged through it, I am still very sensitive to it, even after this amount of time, believe it or not. And I've been out of it now for some 25 years. And I still don't, I would not relish the thought of going back. I wouldn't go back, in fact. Like I said, if I'm going to go negative, I'm just going to do the Nicolas Cage thing and leaving Las Vegas. Kill me in 30 days or less. And I'm not going to go back. I've said this publicly I don't know how many times. And yet people still consider this okay. Well, they're all right. No, they're not. There are people that live within a stone's throw of doctrinal churches and won't cross the street to go there. I mean, literally, I could throw a rock and hit their houses. Yeah, sad. It's the way it goes, though. This is part of the Lupe of the last days. People peel off, go off and do their little thing. Well, 57, if they believe that such activity is acceptable to God as the spiritual form of worship, they will find out otherwise at the Bema Seat. 58, this is why Solomon warns his young audience to watch their steps as they approach the house of God, since he will not suffer fools gladly. And we're going to get that spelled out for us in verse 4. He takes no delight in fools. So 59, in fact, we will see that the wise believer is very often moving in the opposite direction of the foolish believer. The foolish believer is out of step and fools himself into believing he is doing well. And again, Ecclesiastes 10, the heart of the wise man directs him to the right, but the heart of a fool directs him toward the left. So they just part ways, ultimately. The wise and the foolish will part ways, ultimately. You'll have to. Ultimately, you can't continue to walk with fools. A companion of fools will suffer harm. All right, verse 2 now. Do not be hasty in word. Verbal presumption now. or in thought, impulsive in thought, to bring up a matter in the presence of God. The negative AL here plus the PL imperfect of the jussive, which has the sense of a command here. That's the jussive form. There's no, well, I said form because there's no specific form for it, but you have to recognize from context that this is one of the ways that they write a command in Hebrew without using an imperative. Now, you can write a command using an imperative, do thus and such, or don't do thus and such. But essentially, you can also write it in this way, the negative AL, with the PL imperative of Bahal. B-A-H-A-L. There are two roots that are spelled the same way here. This one means to be in a hurry, to be hasty, to engage in a rash action. The sense is to stop the action now. Now, ale with the imperfect is often used in the sense of immediate prohibition. In other words, stopping an action that's already in progress. But what we'll see here is that, in my opinion, the more I studied this, the more I became convinced that that may be an action in progress. But this also shades into permanent prohibition. He's telling them, don't do this in the future either, that this isn't the way to go. So you could translate this, stop being in a hurry. Stop being hasty. In word, literally, is over your mouth, preposition ale here, plus the masculine singular noun construct of pet, P-E-H. It doesn't look like the vowel pointings on that one. I don't know how it happened there. But your mouth, hence your speech. Or impulsive in thought. Here they translated the wow here as slightly adversative. Or in your heart, do not be hasty to go out, as we'll see. In your heart is actually they translated it in thought. You've got the masculine singular noun construct with lev, the word for heart, L-E-V-H. And then again, you've got a negative AL, once again, with a PL jussive here of maher. M-A-H-A-R. This word means with speed or with haste, quickly. Stop, again, if you're translating this as immediate prohibition, you would translate it as stop allowing your heart to be quick. And we've all done this, I suspect. We've all made hasty, impulsive, ill-advised decisions. It happens. Here, the idea is before God the purpose of all of this. Stop allowing your heart to be quick to go out or to bring up is the way they've translated, to cause to go out, a word, a thing, or a matter. You got a prefix lamed with the hipial infinitive construct of yatsah, which means to go out. But the hipial is causative, to cause something to go out, hence to bring it up is the way they've translated it. To cause a matter to go out before God, to the faces literally, prefix lamed plus the common plural noun construct of paneh. And this is another common Hebrew idiom. To the faces of somebody means before them or in front of them. To the faces of the Elohim, definite article plus the word Elohim for God. Because the Elohim is in heaven, in the heavens, literally. In other words, his perspective is transcendent, way above yours. This spatial separation is also designed to impress upon the believer that God's perspective is completely different than yours. So do not be hasty in word or impulsive in thought to bring up a matter before in the presence of God. Now, explanatory here, conjunction key, because the Elohim is in the heavens. Prefix, you got the inseparable preposition bait plus shamayim. S-H-A-M-I-Y-M. S-H-M-A-I-Y-M. Shamayim. And you, supply the to be verb here because there is not one in Hebrew that doesn't exist. And you, again, supply another to-be verb, are the second pronoun upon the earth. Preposition ale, again, spatially located. You're standing on the ground, we might say. And then the definite article plus eris, the feminine singular noun, which means earth, ground, or dry land. Therefore, Let your words be few. Preposition ale plus the adverb ken, this construction itself, ale ken, means exactly that, over thus, literally. So therefore, or on account of this, let become, again, you've got a cal imperfect jussive here, which is, again, a command, essentially. Let your words become few. Daver is the word. A word, a thing, or a matter. And then you got the masculine plural adjective, few, little, or small, me'at. M-E-A-T. For the dream comes to pass through much effort. I've changed the translation up here. I take that back. But I think this actually expresses what they're trying to get at here. Although the connection is, I will have to admit, somewhat obscure. But this would appear to be a proverbial expression of sorts thrown in here. For the dream comes to pass through much effort. I did change the translation. I've supplied the words to pass. In other words, you can dream about something all you want. You have these dreams. But really, the only way you're going to make it happen is hard work. There are some alternate interpretations here, and I will show you, but none of them commended themselves to me. The dream comes to pass through much effort. Here, again, a sort of explanation is offered, key, to reinforce what he has just said. Now, again, the connection, to me, is somewhat obscure, but this is Solomon writing, so we'll have to figure out what he means. Because the dream, well, literally the verb is come, cal perfect of bow, which is exactly means that, to come, comes the dream. Definite article plus the word calom. C-H-A-L-O-M. Because the dream comes in much work, literally. Prefix, you got the inseparable preposition bait with a masculine singular noun of rove. That word, again, great or much. And then you got this word inyon, which he has used before, and it means a task or an occupation or a job or work, whatever you busy yourself with. I-N-Y-A-N. Inyon. And, wow, sound of a fool. You got literally coal, which again, translated in context, coal, Q-O-L. It means sound, but in context, it can mean voice, because obviously your voice makes sounds. Voice of a fool. Kesil is his normal word that he uses throughout here. K-E-S-I-Y-L. The fool, voice of a fool in many words. Again, you have the same construction, the inseparable preposition bait plus rove, great, much, or many, and then the masculine plural noun, words. The var, again, the masculine plural noun. Point one, Solomon continues his exhortations to the younger generation and to all believers by extension with respect to the proper ways to approach God. Two, he has previously counseled believers to give due thought to the issue of the worship of God, and not merely observe the overt requirement and go through the overt motions as fools do. Again, going through the overt motions doesn't impress God. There are people, I guarantee you there are thousands, millions, hundreds of millions of people in churches today. And they're going through a certain level of motions. They're doing certain things. They got up, they got dressed, just like you and I did, came to class. But they're not going to hear any real teaching. But they're going to go through all the typical fundy things that they do. They're going to get up, they're going to pray, and they're going to take an offering, and then they're going to sing three or four songs, then they're going to have the choir come out and do a special, and then the preacher's going to get up, he's going to tell them to open the Bible and turn to a certain verse or passage, he's going to read it, and then for all intents and purposes, they can close their Bible because he's just going to pontificate after that. And then they're going to sing 19 stanzas of "This Is Just As I Am" until enough people come down the aisle until he's convinced that, you know, this is it. And that's the way a Fundy service goes. And for those of us who've been out there, you can all validate that. But all they're doing is going through the motions. They're not pleasing God. They're not impressing God. Because there is no real spiritual reality behind it all. Well, three, he now moves to the verbal realm, dealing first with the matter of prayer and the restraint that is necessary when one approaches God. For the verse is actually divided into three parts, which include an initial command, possibly a proverbial expression there, do not be hasty in word or impulsive in thought. I don't think it's a proverb, that part of it, but I acknowledge it could be. A motive for obeying the command. The motive is found in the middle part of the verse. For God is in heaven and you are on the earth. And then a second command related to the first. Therefore, let your words be few. Five here in verse 4, he will continue with the matter of restraint with respect to the issue of vows. 6, what Solomon states here very much corresponds with the thinking of the traditional wisdom teaching of Israel. One of the things, of course, that troubles people is sometimes Solomon parts ways with the traditional thinking in Israel, the traditional wisdom approach, because he has observed enough in life to know that that's not always true. These proverbial expressions are not always true in every case. God blesses the righteous and jams the wicked. Not always, not in every case. But generally speaking, is that the way God operates? Yes. But is it true in every matter, everyone? No. No, again, these proverbs are not designed to be universal in every case. But the point is, but very much throughout this book, he's very much in tune with the traditional wisdom teaching in Israel. So this corresponds to that. 7, the sages advocated thought before speech, so as to avoid making rash remarks that might later cause the speaker some unanticipated trouble. Proverbs 10:19. And while we don't always do it perfectly, I think deep down, hopefully, within our heart of hearts, we all know that it's wiser to think before you talk. And we may not always do it. We may blurt out, you know, trip over our tongue, pull our pants down in public. I mean, not physically, but, you know, verbally. But I think what most of us know, have the sense to know that, yeah, it's wiser to think before you speak. Don't think before you speak. Proverbs 10:19. Where there are many words, transgression is unavoidable. But he who restrains his lips is wise. And in Proverbs 20:25. It is a trap for a man to say rashly. It is holy. And after the vows, to make inquiry. So, again, do your homework. Think before you talk. We would all lay hands on that and say, yeah, that's right. 8, one area in which the believer is advised to watch his speech is the matter of becoming surety for someone else. This is warned against repeatedly. Proverbs 6, 1 and 2. And you get yourself into trouble. My son, if you have become surety for your neighbor, have given your pledge for a stranger. If you have been snared with the words of your mouth, and you have been caught with the words of your mouth, do this and deliver yourself. Get out of it, if at all possible. Because this is where people get into trouble. We might say today, the modern term we would use for this is co-signing, guaranteeing somebody else's debt. This gets people into trouble. Proverbs 11:15, this is an area that is warned against. He who is guarantor for a stranger will surely suffer for it. But he who hates being a guarantor is secure. Now what happens? Sometimes we get into guilt. We feel guilty. We think, okay, this person needs help, and so I'll help them. Even though in these verses, of course, you know, I'm back as a fundy again. I remember, you know, we were in this prison ministry, and we had, you know, we tended to deal with the lesser people in society. The ex-cons, the drug addicts, the prostitutes, you know, all that. So these people would get out. They'd need help. You know, I remember. I mean, I knew these verses. Even as a fundy, I knew these verses. This guy wanted to get on his feet, so I went down and signed for him to get a telephone. Well, guess what? Got stuck with a $200 phone bill. And I thought to myself, that's a good lesson. I better commit this one to memory. And going surety for people just leads to trouble. So Proverbs 17:18. I've learned this lesson the hard way many times, unfortunately, in my life. A man lacking in sense pledges and becomes a guarantor in the presence of a neighbor. So just if you feel guilty and if people don't have enough, don't feel bad about it. It's not your job. Just recognize that this will get you into trouble down the road. Proverbs 22:26. Do not be among those who give pledges, among those who become guarantors for debts. If you have nothing with which to pay, why should he take your bed out from under you? And believe me, the bank will. They won't care. They won't say, well, you got yourself into this, you know, well, I can't pay it. So, again, this is one area in which speech is ill-advised. 9, the construction beginning at the beginning of verse 2 employs the construction, the preposition ale, no or not, with the imperfect form of the verb. Again, jussive in meaning, i.e. imperatival. 10, this is generally used to express immediate prohibition and would normally be translated, stop being in a hurry. And 11, this may very well be what Solomon intends, since he recognizes the tendency of youth toward rash behavior, and so instructs his readers to stop such activity. And again, you have a similar construction that's used in the Greek that can mean immediate prohibition, but you have to be careful. One of the things I've learned over the years through the study of the languages is that certain things that have been said dogmatically can't be proven. You know, this construction always means this. You better believe it. And I've come to find out through study, wait a minute, the construction doesn't always mean that. I can give you examples. I've heard it taught dogmatically for years. Only God controls the weather. Really? Well, what are you going to do with the book of Job? Throw it out? It's my opinion Satan can control the weather sometimes under God's permissive will. And Job would testify to that, I'll bet. And so guess what? You hear something, and just because it's been dogmatically ingrained in you, don't assume that it's always correct. You have to be willing to stop. And this is a part of intellectual honesty. You've got to be willing to stop and look at this and say, does this hold water? Is this always true? Generally speaking, yes, God controls the weather. But is it true in every case? No. And I can give you a verse to prove it. So this construction here, I've heard this construction. This always means immediate prohibition. Well, does it really? That may be an emphasis of it, but it doesn't always mean that. And so this is where you've got to be willing to stop and look and think. And this is where you've got to hold up your theological grid to great scrutiny. And what you've been taught to great scrutiny. Okay. All right. I've been taught this. And I'm thoroughly grateful for all the instruction I got in seminary. And it surely laid the groundwork so that I could be a capable exegete. But I've learned certain things. No, that doesn't work that way all the time. So certain things, maybe I just didn't pay close enough attention in seminary. Maybe they told me it didn't work that way all the time. But some cases, I know I was taught certain things, and I've had to look at them and say, well, you know, that doesn't fit here. This verse tends to disprove that. So again, here I would suggest point 12. However, it should be understood that the command does have an ongoing emphasis. One should stop being hasty if he is doing so now. Further, he should not be hasty in the future. I don't think this is just stop doing it now. I think it's stop doing it, period. But if you're doing it now, obviously stop now. So 13, Solomon addresses the two major areas in which people manifest a tendency to be impulsive. The mouth and the thought processes. 14, although the idea is not being rash in the mental attitude or with your mouth is taught in other places, it seems that Solomon offers here a perspective that is unique to him. 15, the motive he offers is that of the relative positions of men and God. A God is in heaven and we're on the earth. Well, that wouldn't be new news to anybody that was in Israel. They would have acknowledged that. Believers, you know, most normal believers would acknowledge that, but what's his point? Well, 16, some of interpreters have sought to understand this in the sense that God is far removed from the human condition and is therefore indifferent to our circumstances. Now, this is the belief of deism. Deism is a doctrine that essentially says, I'm trying to simplify it. You can't get every little subtle nuance. It'd take me hours to explain deism. But substantially it says that God kind of started all this up and then sort of withdrew and has not intervened in human history to speak of since then. And that he stays removed and aloof from all of this, and that he's never done anything. And of course, that rules out any supernatural activity that God might have done. And rules out, you're going to have to throw out a lot of the Bible to be a deist, frankly. Because it says God did thus and such. The deist would say, well, no, he really didn't. And I watched, and some people, and again, we want to be rational thinking people, but I've watched some people that they rely on rationalism to try to explain everything. And you can't explain everything with rationalism. I was watching a program yesterday on National Geographic about the Exodus. And they were trying to offer explanations as to why these plagues occurred the way they did. And now there was some rational thought in their deal. They didn't acknowledge, they acknowledged, okay, God did these plagues, but the order in which they occurred, they suggested, it made some sense. That God would do this. The first one was the Nile becoming blood, and that the water became foul. Well, this killed a bunch of fish and frogs who all washed up on the land, and guess what feeds on dead, rotting carcasses? You know, and it's this little midge that's over there, that's this biting midge, and so this explains the swarm of the gnats. And then the next plague leads into the next one. And there were some rational explanation for what went on, but the reality is, bottom line, God did them. Or set up the circumstances by which they occur, we would say. We're not trying to explain things away in that God never did anything. And of course, then you get to certain of the plagues and you can't rationally explain them. How is it that it's dark in all the land of Egypt, but it's daylight in Israel, and where the Israelites were living, in that part of Egypt? How do you explain the death of only the firstborn of men and animals? Now, they tried to offer a rationalistic explanation, but it doesn't ultimately hold water. Well, it was this plague, you know. They said it was some strain of the bubonic plague. Well, how did it only kill just the firstborn? Once a family was infected and all of that. And they explained this plague is coming off the plague of the rats and the mice and all that. And again, they had some realistic, at least, ideas. But did that fully explain everything? No, because they were trying to do it with strictly a rational approach. Well, the deist tends to be much more of a rationalist because he doesn't think God's done anything or is doing anything. So 17, however, it seems far more likely that he is emphasizing the fact that the vast difference in space is symbolic of the vast difference in perspective between God and man. Not that God's disinterested. That's one view of this verse, but that doesn't hold water to me. 18, the emphasis is on God's supremacy, his complete understanding, and his sovereign rule over the world. This is contrasted with man's perspective, which is comprised of only a small portion of planet Earth and a relatively small number of events that comprise his life. Think about your life. You're however old you are, 30, 35, 40, 50, 60, however old you are. And think about all the things that have happened in your life. You say, well, that's a lot. It's drop in the ocean. Very small. Compare the number of people on planet Earth. 6.5 billion and growing at this point. How many people are on the planet? And all the things that have happened in their lives. Just the people that are alive today. And then the people that have lived before and all the things that happened in their lives and back and on and on and on. And the things yet to come. So your life is very limited. You have a very limited perspective on things. We all do. But God doesn't. God sees it all. 19, the fact that God is in heaven and we are on earth emphasizes his complete separation from that which is not compatible with his righteousness. Psalm 11:4. The spatial separation is also designed, I believe, emphasize God is above all this, we might say. Not that he's not involved or doesn't care, but he sees things in different ways than we do. The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. Behold, his eyelids test the sons of men. The Lord tests the righteous and the wicked. Well, this would go against deism, which says God doesn't do anything, of course. But he tests the righteous and the wicked. So he lives in heaven. He lives along, we might say, quote, a long ways away. But does this mean he's uninvolved or he doesn't pay attention or any of that? No, it doesn't emphasize that. Habakkuk 1:13 also. Your eyes are too pure to approve evil, literally to look upon evil. And hence the idea to look upon it, to observe it, to give it any kind of a stamp of approval. You cannot look on wickedness with favor. Why do you look with favor on those who deal treacherously? Why are you silent when the wicked swallow up those more righteous than they? Well, here emphasizes again God's complete separation in that he's holy. And 20, although some have understood this warning as Solomon's way of saying that believers should only approach God in prayer on rare occasions. Well, this would be the only verse in the Bible that makes such an assertion. And I don't think that's the thrust of this. He's not saying, as it were, well, don't pray much because, you know, God's in heaven and you're on earth. I mean, we have other verses that would completely contradict that viewpoint. You know, pray at all times. Pray about all things continually. Bring all your anxiety and everything before the Lord. We got tons of verses that would contradict that. So I don't think that's what Solomon is saying. What he is saying is that you need to be careful. Again, he's counseling restraint to his younger audience. 21, he is not advising people to approach God occasionally, nor is he suggesting that one makes the time in prayer as brief as possible. This is one view one interpreter had, because we might be wasting God's time, see? And God's not interested, and don't waste his time. That's not what he's saying here. At least I don't see that as what he's saying here. So 22, he is advising his audience to consider the fact that God's perspective is far greater than ours. And we should avoid any form of presumption given this fact. Since we know this about God, that God sees everything, knows everything, that he's been through, as it were, everything. And we haven't. We don't know. We don't see. God can see the future. See, we can't see around the corner. God can. To the extent, you know, that he allows you sometimes to see around the corner. Shoot, watching people out there drive, they can't even see the stoplight in front of them, let alone around the corner. They can't see what's right in front of their face half the time. So again, he is advising his audience to consider the fact that God's perspective is far greater than ours, and so we should avoid presumption given this fact. All right, well, our time's up. We will stop there and continue on here with this on Wednesday. Thank you, Father, for the privilege of studying your word. May God the Holy Spirit sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.